This is Sutta 90 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Kanakatala Sutta. So that the main dialogue is involved with King Pasenadi, questions the Buddha on omniscience, on caste distinction, and on the gods. So what I'll do is I'll move this. I won't race through it, but I'll just give you the opportunity to basically question anything at any time. It doesn't matter if it's like related or not. I'm more than happy to discuss your inquiries. So thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Arjuna in the Kanakatala Deer Park. Now, on that occasion, King Pasenadi of Kosala had arrived at Arjuna for some business or other. Then he told a man, "Come, good man, go to the Blessed One and pay homage in my name with your head at his feet and ask whether he is free from from illness and affliction and is healthy, strong and abiding in comfort, saying, 'Venerable Sir, King Pasenadi of Kosala pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet, and he asks whether the Blessed One is free from illness and abiding in comfort, and say this, Venerable Sir, today King Pasenadi of Kosala will come to see the Blessed One after he has had his breakfast.'" And that comment, you know, like breakfast, it's something that they use in Thailand a fair bit, you know, for the main meal, because with the actual timing, most of the monks eat their breakfast probably around, say, 8 a.m., which is slightly after, or maybe at the same time, was slightly after, say, the lay community would take their own, and they usually finished up by about 9 a.m. "Yes, sir," the man replied, and he went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and delivered his message. The sisters Soma and Sakula heard, "Today King Pasenadi of Kosala will go to see the Blessed One after he has had his breakfast." So with the reference there, the reference, you know, calling them sisters, but they in fact were the wives of the king. "Then while the meal was being served, the two sisters went to the king and said, 'Sire, pay homage in our name with your head at the Blessed One's feet and ask whether he is free from illness and abiding in comfort,' saying, 'Venerable Sir, the sisters Soma and Sakula pay homage with their heads at the Blessed One's feet and they ask whether he is free from illness and abiding in comfort.' Then when he had finished his breakfast, King Pasenadi of Kosala went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and delivered the message of the sisters Soma and Sakula." So I was talking with Achan, some teachers in Thailand about the, you know, both Achan Brahm about the, and the some teachers in Thailand about the, just the repetitious nature of the sutta structure, and one of the reasons is that essentially is that people can remember them, you know, basically remember them from memory, because as all of you are aware that, you know, very few people can learn something just on one occasion and actually stay, and it sticks in memory for quite a long period of time. You know, usually for the vast majority of us, we have to use this kind of repetitious approach with memory retention, but it's not always the case, because if people have developed, say, like skills with being able to remember and recall, you know, like say, like suttas or you know, any kind of intellectual knowledge, people can develop specific skills, but, you know, at that time they would have placed a reasonable amount of emphasis on repetition. But also in the Greek tradition, they were known as famous mnemonics. You know, they had a number of skills. You know, they actually trained themselves in order to recall just vast quantities of material. I don't know the exact time scale when the Greeks were actually doing this in history, but they were quite famous for that. But great king, could the sister Soma and Sakula find no other messenger? Venerable sir, the sisters Soma and Sakula heard. Today, King Pasanadi of Kosala will go to see the Blessed One after he has had his breakfast. Then, while the meal was being served, the sisters Soma and Sakula came to me and said, Sire, pay homage in our names with your head at the Blessed One's feet and ask whether he is free from illness and abiding in comfort. May the sisters Soma and Sakula be happy, great king. Then King Pasanadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, I have heard this. The recluse Gotama says there is no recluse or Brahman who is omniscient and all-seeing, who can claim to have complete knowledge and vision. That is not possible. Venerable Sir, do those who speak thus say what has been said by the Blessed One and not misrepresent him with what is contrary to fact? Do they explain in accordance with the Dhamma in such a way that nothing that provides grounds for censure can be legitimately deduced from their assertions? So that reference in relation to the ability of omniscience on the level of the mind, all knowing, all seeing. Sometimes you hear that, you read that kind of statement in other traditions, but within the Buddhist tradition, because we have this emphasis on the mind and the way that consciousness works, that with each individual, a person can have an incredibly fast mind. They can have a mind like a laser beam, incredibly precise and sharp, incredibly fast. But the reality still holds that a person can only think of one thing at any time. As you look at the stream of consciousness, as a person, say, like intends or thinks or ponders or problem solves, that they can only apply the mind to, say, one subject, one thought process at any time. Like when I was years ago, my father had a German engineering foreman who had an incredibly fast mind, and he would say things like he could think of maybe four or five things at the same time, but in reality, that's not possible. It might certainly be possible in the space of maybe 2 or 3 seconds. You have individuals who are mentally incredibly speedy, but when you actually break it down to a much finer level, when you're looking at thought moments and the stream of consciousness, a person can only focus, say, on one thing at any time within their awareness. Great king, those who speak thus do not say what has been said by me, but misrepresent me with what is untrue and contrary to fact. Then King Pasanadi of Kosala addressed General Widubana, General, who introduced this story into the palace? It was Sanjaya Sai, the Brahmin of the Akasa clan. Then King Pasanadi of Kosala told a man, Come, good man, in my name, tell Sanjaya, the Brahmin of the Akasa clan, Venerable Sir, King Pasanadi of Kosala calls you. Yes, sire, the man replied. He went to Sanjaya, the Brahmin of the Akasa clan, and told him, Venerable Sir, King Pasanadi of Kosala calls you. Meanwhile, King Pasanadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, could something else have been said by the Blessed One referring to that, and the person understood it wrongly? In what way does the Blessed One recall making that utterance? I recall having actually made the utterance in this way, great king. There is no recluse or Brahman who knows all, who sees all simultaneously. That is not possible. So there was also, let's see. Yeah, so that, there's also that reference there with the Anguttara Nikaya, like 4.24, that stroke 224. So where the Buddha said that he claimed to know all that can be sensed, heard, sensed, cognized. So within the five senses, you know, being an assertion of omniscience in the sense of, you know, where the person has actually realized the Dhamma, not only say becoming an arahant, because even within, say, for example, within the Thai tradition, where you have teachers who have, you know, attained full purification of mind, you know, you'll actually see grades or what's the right word? Say like differences on the mental level between, say, one arahant and another. You know, like one arahant will, you know, they're the same in the sense that they fully, you know, you have full purification of mind, full removal of the defilements, you know, the realization of Dhamma, because the actual realization of say Nibbana, the unconditioned occurs at every stage, you know, the four stages, you know, leading up to arahanthood. But as you move from stage to stage, you see an increase in the insight knowledge, and quite possibly an increase in the psychic range, psychic ability, powers. But even between in the supposed arahants, that you will find differences in faculties, where you know, you'll have an arahant who is very capable of communicating and teaching their disciples, and they may have the personal qualities, the personality, I wouldn't say like structure, like, but the appearance of personality, which allows them to use that you know, that past personality, which was conditioned to assist and to teach other people. But you will get fully enlightened disciples of the Buddha who don't have a great capacity to teach others. So, and also, you know, you'll see a difference in the you know, in the wisdom range and the ability to like to connect with people, and the ability to actually guide them. So on the, you know, on the personal level, even though they all have full purification of mind, and they share in a number of say insight knowledges, you know, all the essential insight knowledges connected to the four levels. But there's going to be say like character differences, different potentials when it comes to the say the teaching position, or even say the management position. There'll always be a minimum level of wisdom there, you know, arising from both from just raw insight and from the meditation practice in its sense, because even as arahants, that you find the vast majority of them, they just don't put their feet up and take it easy and relax. You usually find they're quite energetic and quite dynamic, you know, depending on the character. You may have some characters who are very reclusive, but some who seek to engage and teach people on a regular basis. So what the Blessed One has said appears reasonable. What the Blessed One has said appears to be supported by reason. So when we talk, when you use that word reason in the sense of, say, like making sense and making sense in within the, essentially like the reality principle, because all of you are well aware. You know, don't be afraid to, if you want to argue or bring up a point, but, you know, so when the thing is, say, accords with reason or accords with sense, that it's something which, in its essence, it accords with reality. If it makes perfect sense to you, you tend to find that it's quite close to the reality principle, the reality experience of an individual. Otherwise, the person can see the faults in the in a person, in the way of maybe a person explains a particular topic or an aspect of Dhamma. Because, you know, if you're talking about true Dhamma principles, you know, they should be foolproof. They should be, if you know your stuff, you should be able to. You don't even have to argue. You know, you just you set forward what you know. You're under. You know what. You know, especially if you're attained. You know that person. Then they really know what they're talking about. While people say below the level of those who've attained enlightenment, that you know we still. If you've got the jhanas where you've got some real stillness of mind, then you've got an ability to. The data that you actually take in through your senses is quite reliable, because your personality structure is not filtering, it's not distorting what is actually coming in through your senses. You know, this is why there's so much emphasis put on samadhi practice, and then you have this ongoing dispute about, dry insight, arahants and whatnot. You know, it's just basically it's not possible. You know, virtually every case that we've seen, both in Burma, Thailand, you've got to have at least upachara samadhi in order to break through to the path, because your defilements just won't allow you. You just can't perceive and investigate. In a crystal clear fashion, to the point where you can actually remove those underlying obstructions and purify the mind. This is the reason why they make such, very senior meditation teachers make such a fuss about the samadhi practice, because as long as your personality is still active and operating, we just can't really see what's going on, and the power to remove those, say, underlying defilements or, say, spiritual afflictions, as Bhante Gunaratana would say, it's just not, the person just doesn't have the ability. There are these four castes, Venerable Sir, the nobles, the Brahmins, the merchants and the workers. Is there any distinction or difference among them? There are these four castes, great king, the nobles, the Brahmins, the merchants and the workers. Two of them, that is the nobles and the Brahmins, are held to be superior, since men pay homage to them, rise up for them and accord them reverential salutation and polite services. Venerable Sir, I was not asking about this present life, I was asking about the life to come. So that was there was the with the reference note, the 847. So the Buddha, the inquiry is in relation with the not in relation with the social status, but about the person's potential for spiritual progress and attainment. There are these four castes, Venerable Sir, the nobles, the Brahmins, the merchants, and the workers. Is there any distinction or difference among them? Great King, there are these five factors of striving. What five? Here a bhikkhu has, or here a practitioner has faith. He places his faith in the Tathagata's enlightenment thus. The Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tame, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. That particular statement, there was a book written, it was an article in a book where a particular gentleman made reference that he thought the the Buddha was, you know, suffering from incredibly, like, sort of grandiose delusions, you know, like making, the, you know, these kind of very, very highfalutin statements. But, you know, with the, you know, but with that it sounds quite, even as highfalutin as it sounds, it's a reality principle. You know, when they talk about perfect in true knowledge, you know, the person, they understand, you know, their comprehension, their understanding is absolutely perfectly accurate and true, you know, with true knowledge, and their personal conduct, you know, sublime, very refined in nature, no other worlds, you know, because the ability of the, you know, the ability to project the mind out into other worlds is there, you know, especially, you know, even for people who've got upachara samadhi, you have the potential to do that. That's the stage when a person can actually start to manifest psychic abilities. So a person, there's enough power in the mind to recollect past lives. There's, you know, there's enough power in the mind to develop and actually hone different psychic skills. And they can be useful. They can be both, you know, it's like the internet, both useful and a distraction. You know, psychic skills you can actually use to further your insight knowledge, to increase your knowledge base, you know, to understand the karma of other beings, to see what's actually happening in the world, or to see what's happening in higher or lower realms. You can actually project your mind into these worlds and then learn what's actually happening in that time and space, and use that as your raw material for your reflection, for your wisdom practice. So if you actually apply it in the correct manner, you know, you can generate, you can increase your wisdom faculty potential through the exercise of psychic power. But naturally, you know, people can get distracted. They could spend an excessive amount of time on you know, like coming to know exactly what's, you know, what's actually going on in the world, around the world, in other realms, or even in say reading people's minds and this type of thing. You know, it's sort of like similar to the internet, where you can draw on useful information, but maybe a lot of the stuff that you're taking in, it really doesn't increase the quality of your life to any great degree, and it might be just a complete waste of time. And this is the reason why we will probably never have internet in the monastery at Bodhinyana, and we will never have mobile phones, because it's just too much of a distraction. You know? People could waste hours and hours absorbing information. Okay. And then he is free from illness and affliction, possessing a good digestion that is neither too cool nor too warm, but medium and able to bear the strain of striving. So this business with striving, and virtually anyone that you see, you know, within the forest tradition, the person who has attained even the first stage of Dhamma as the Sotapanna, these people, you know, they put forth, I mean, a lot of effort into their practice. I mean, even with the case histories of people that we've heard or seen previously, I mean, the vast majority of people, they never do anything less than 5 to 6 hours on a daily basis, and that's just cruising, you know. For some people, like Achandan, or even long Achandan, I mean, he would do even up to like absolute minimum 10, 12 hours a day. Longpo Plien up to 16, because when he was really working the meditation practice, I mean, he only actually needed to physically sleep like 1 hour every 24-hour cycle. And because the meditation is so profound, you know, they just rest in, say, fourth jhana for
several hours, and they can just do that, I mean, for really long periods of time. They could do easily like months on end, you know. Unless you know, if you're on a project where you're shoveling sand and gravel, like maybe half a day or all day, you know, physically they may be quite necessary to rest more for longer periods of time. But you know, it just makes you realize what the mind and body is capable of. When you have that level of meditation, you don't need to rest very much at all. Even let's see now, from Wat Pa Pong, the current abbot at Wat Pa Pong, when he went a rains retreat without doing this, you know, the sitter's practice, where essentially he wouldn't lay down to sleep. But you know, you also have other people who've done that, you know, say enlightened disciples or people with deep meditation, and that kind of practice is quite workable, and you won't get too many adverse effects. But we've had monks in our monastery, maybe three over the years that I know of, and who've done the sitter's practice, but they didn't necessarily have very deep meditation beyond the normal range, and you end up with this kind of, but it takes a lot of strength. It's not like tut-tutting this kind of approach, because to keep that up, you've really got to be mentally quite strong. It's not for sissies, that one. And so the person, you know, they just sleep sitting up, you know, because they've got to rest the mind. They don't have the deep meditation. They can't rest the mind in deep states of tranquility. And if they don't even sleep in the sitting position, the mind can become quite disturbed. People can start to hallucinate, become mentally disturbed, this type of thing, just because the mind's just not getting any rest whatsoever. You know, what do they call it? People start to fantasize or even develop like mild psychosis. But most of the monks that we know who were able to keep it up, they tended to fight sleep on a day-to-day basis. You know, you could see that they were tired, and they weren't, you know, they just weren't resting properly, and they were just quite drowsy, and basically they just weren't safe with power tools, chainsaws, this type of thing. You know, people would stumble, they would fall asleep at the breakfast and the main meal, so it was very clear that the mind and body was just not getting enough rest. Then the disciple, they are honest and sincere and show themselves as they actually are to their teacher and his companions in the holy life. So that's in reference to a person who's, you know, I mean, quite sort of transparent in their behaviour. And, you know, they don't, what would you call it? It's like being, they don't sort of put on a show. They're not necessarily, say, two-faced or deceptive. You know, as you see the person, you know, that's who they are. You don't see any kind of double take. Yep. Is that with the sitter's practice or general? Those particular individuals were monks. They've probably been ordained for at least, say, 5 years plus. Let's say minimum 5 years up to 15. But the thing is, I mean, it's all well and good to do that particular practice. Some people need to see if it actually like works for them, because I brought up the point that, you know, with this particular monk who was with us, he was just drowsy all the time, and I said to one of the junior monks, how can you possibly get good meditation in that state? Because the person hasn't got enough alertness, mental energy. And that particular monk did speak to Ajahn Brahm about his practice, and he had got quite some very good states in the past. But the thing is, you know, you may have to size the complete picture up. And, you know, it's all very nice to get good states of meditation, but that ongoing type of practice, did it actually give good results in the long term? You know, not to say that the insight, you know, the meditation and the insight that he had was trifling. It may not have been the case, but if you see him years later, you know, maybe he's been doing that practice for, say, minimum 2, 3, 4 years, and they don't get any really substantial results, and you know, they're compromising their you know, their personal health and their, you know, and their safety to a degree, you know, in extreme situations. I wouldn't support it. Ajahn Brahm, you know, he made the point, you know, that, you know, if the body and mind's telling you it has to rest, and you just keep forcing, you know, you just keep trying to sustain that practice, but it's absolutely crystal clear that you're just not getting enough rest, and you're not getting, you know, if you can get the jhanas with that kind of approach, I mean, all well and good, you know. I would, if I could be guaranteed of getting the jhanas, I mean, I would do it myself. But the thing is, they don't. But you have teachers in Burma who, like say Webu Sayadaw, and he would have his lay disciples. Like, he did the sitter's practice for many years. I don't know exactly how much of his monk's life, but it was a phenomenal, you know, chunk of his monastic life. And also, but he would encourage his lay disciples to do the sitter's practice as well, and that method of following the breath continually, like, you know, I mean, like 16 hours a day while you're awake, you know, right throughout the day and half the night. But, you know, I mean, not many people can handle that kind of intensity, and I wouldn't recommend it unless you get, I mean, just incredible results from it. If you're an arahant, I mean, you know, you can do things like that. Even if you're a sotapanna, I mean, potentially, you know, you could do that and still function like reasonably well. You know, even as much as I mean, Ajahn Brahm's very energetic, and mentally he is really, really tough. You know, and even with the monks that we see from Thailand, you know, even the very senior monks from Wat Pa Phong, you know, they can't practice like him. You know, they can't, the kind of practice style that he has, both practice, teaching format, you know, running the monastery, you know, different centres, you know, helping out with the bhikkhunis and, you know, Jhana Grove and overseas centres, and he's got all sorts of stuff happening. I mean, you know, the vast majority of these guys, they just couldn't hack it, you know, basically. And so the, you know, that, you know, when you're, especially when you're at the first level, you know, as the sotapanna, that your ability is really, it's way beyond the normal range, what you can actually do, the amount of energy you can put forth, and the amount of people you can teach, and the amount of travelling, you know, fundraising, and how much stress, you know, what you can take on and deal with, and how long you can do it. You know, it's almost like being a business executive, what do they call those people at the very top of corporate, like a CEO. It's like being a CEO in robes. That's how busy the job is, and how much you've got on your plate. But he gets tired, but he doesn't breathe hard. You know, Ajahn Brahm, he doesn't breathe hard, he doesn't get stressed, he doesn't get angry virtually at all. He may get, you know, when the pressure is really on and everything's falling apart, he might get maybe irritated, but that's probably about as bad as it gets. An incredible tolerance for pressure and stress, and you know, just the capability to teach, to understand, teach people, and you know, being very skillful, different approaches with practice and whatnot.
It seems to me, Bhante, that it's really about the batting average in terms of mental equilibrium and stability, and then you might be able to sit in meditation for 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours and get wonderful insight. But if you average that out over 7 days or 7 weeks, does that have a net advantage on your life? So, you know, I understand what you're saying about Ajahn Brahm being showing up with a really good batting average. He's got that durability and sustainability, and also probably he's got the ability to pierce into deep places of meditation. My experience has been personally to be able to go sometimes to deep places, but that has to be sort of rationalised with the rest of what I do in my life. And I wanted to ask you a question about householders and meditation, and because it seems to me that a lot of time when people come along to this place and become interested in the Dharma, they, you know, a lot of people come here for curiosity's sake and they stay for maybe a couple of years and then go away. But then there are a bunch of us who hang around a little bit longer and a lot longer than that and are practicing Dharma in a serious way. But there seems to be a point where there's a ceiling, a glass ceiling for householders where you've really got to make decisions about how your life's going to be seriously in terms of the following of the Dharma and the deep practices of meditation. And living in a household life and having responsibilities limits that to a point where, you know, you have time constraints and you have to go and do other things because you're a householder. And I think that there's a point where householders get to where they have to make a serious decision whether they're going to alter their lifestyles in a very deep way to actually incline the mind and the lifestyle more towards being monk-like. In other words, their houses are quiet, they don't have helter-skelter. It's good if you've got rid of your kids, that's always good. Then there seems to be an opportunity to actually create conditions which then you can use to practice in a deeper level. And that leads around to my question that when you want to start sitting, I've noticed, for example, if I sit, you know, a couple of hours a day, which is what I sit average, okay? But if I up that up to 2 and 3 and 4 hours a day, you get a different, you drop up to a different gears, like changing gears psychically, energetically, and from then on, you start to have very different personal experiences of the world. And my question is, and it relates back to what you were just saying before, associated with those monks who are sitting sort of 6 hours a day or something like that. I think you do get a return on your on the meditation if you do start to sit long periods of time. But it seems to me that it's almost impossible to do that if you don't make serious accommodations to the fact that the mind needs to be in a place of stillness, can't be sort of, for example, sitting long periods of time and then going out and doing the shopping down at Coles. That is disastrous, you know. I'd be interested in your comments about that that finer accommodation when people are seriously making commitments to the Dharma past just the little half-hour sits in the morning or the half-hour sits in the evening. Does one need to actually create a structure and a support system around them for accommodating that increased sensitivity, which in my experience certainly comes to the point of almost like developing a little bit of psychic sort of intuitiveness? And is that something where one can come to grief, or is there something where one needs to, as a householder who's seriously committed, put in more safeguards?
Yeah, with the, you know, each person, you know, they're well aware of their, you know, especially with the nature of their home life, exactly what they've got on their plate as far as the their work, you know, children and partner and any additional responsibilities. So it's like, you know, you know exactly what you have to deal with in your day-to-day life, and you know, you're going to have lay disciples who are very focused and committed, and they may be able to, they're prepared to put effort into, you know, increasing effort into meditation, chanting, study and the like. You know, they might have a very well-rounded practice, you know, covering different, you know, all areas of Dharma practice. But you know yourself when you reach your workable limit. You know, you know because you've got your family, you've got, you know, full time work. You know you can feel it. You know exactly how the high point, how far you can take it, how much meditation you can do. You know, because the thing is, you know, if you're not there for your partner and kids, you know, it creates conflict and problems. And
yeah.
So, you know, each person, you know, very, very individual. Each person knows they over time, as the months and 1 or 2, 3 years go by, they can feel exactly what's the extent of the range, how much practice, you know, how much they can involve themselves within their Dharma focus. But the thing is, you know, you can get contradiction in terms, because we had a person connected to the monastery years ago, and the monks knew him quite well. And this guy was like, he was sitting absolute minimum, like 4 to 5 hours, I mean, every single day. And he was living in a very quiet place. I think it was way out the back of, it was in the Armidale area, but up towards the foothills, a very, very quiet place. He wasn't working, and the monks said, look, you're just living, you know, so quietly, you're not working for a living, you're very, very interested in meditation. Why don't you just come to the monastery and ordain? And his argument was that he felt that he would actually have less time in the monastery for his personal practice, because he was, you know, very much a meditator before anything else. And he felt, especially, you know, because with the Anagarika training, I mean, the guys are just so busy, just constantly, you know, they're driving, they're helping out in the monastery on projects, doing this, that, and the other, and it's the busiest year of you know, easily the first 5-7 years when people train themselves, and they spend half their time just like running around for other people. And even when, you know, I mean, the guys that we've got, they hardly complain at all, amazingly. but with the lay disciple, you know exactly how far you can take your practice, but it depends on your level of personal commitment and how committed you are with your family. You know, I mean, if you love your wife and kids, you know, you can only allocate so much for Dharma practice, and you've got to give the rest to your family. You know, you've got to work full time, and but you know, you may reach a point, you know, as you mentioned, having the kids off your hand. You know, they're out of your hair, and possibly one's partner might give one permission to ordain and give it at least, you know, give it at least one, two, three years, and then just see if it actually works out for you. For some people, it may not. For some people, it may be exactly what they need. You know, they're prepared to give it 100%, and they're prepared to ordain for that. But you know yourself, there's a lot of variables at work there, and you have to weigh everything up. And it's not just yourself, it's your family, and possibly even friends and whatnot, expectations within the family, especially if people are, say, like multicultural, could be Greek or Italian, and the parents, they're dead against the son or the daughter, you know, like going to the Buddhist monastery and ordaining. So, you know, I have a number of things there. But I think the bottom line is you just weigh, the synopsis is you just weigh everything up, and then you could even find a compromise situation. You could have a family structure where the younger ones, they're already at the teenage level, and one's partner actually gives one permission to go to the monastery for a full 12 months with no strings attached, you know, so the person can commit themselves, and then they absolutely know for sure if they're ready to stay on for maybe 2, 3, 4 years. So you know, it's very, it's got to be really be a heart-based decision. If you're a single person, you know you don't have to answer to anyone. You can just make your decision and go. But you know, say for example in the family, if you can't afford to stop work, or if your partner just refuses to let you go, or the kids are unhappy about it, you know, or there's, you know, the house isn't paid off, you know, so you know exactly what's happening there. And but if you can't make a full commitment now, you might have the opportunity to do that, you know, it's maybe in 4 or 5 years, depending on your circumstances. Only you know, when you weigh everything up, you know exactly what you can do.
Yeah, but the implication from what you're saying is that the path ahead is to go into becoming a monk, and that's what I'm questioning. What I'm saying is the glass ceiling. Okay, if you live, for example, my place is quieter than your monastery. I personally think it's quieter than your monastery. I'm saying this, does the glass ceiling that you're talking about slowly rise as you deepen in your practice? You may well end up joining a monastery or something like that, but the point about it is that may be a number of different options. But my question is, is there a capacity for having those limitations slowly lifted from you as you deepen your practice?
You keep developing to a higher level,
yeah,
as a lay practitioner.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. As long as you've got the supporting conditions, exactly what obstructs your practice.
Yeah.
You've only got to look inside your mind and you can see what the things which actually slow you down or block you. So if those things, they're either not there or there to a small degree, if you put skillful effort into your practice, even if things are going crazy around you, you're still going to develop. Not as fast as if you've got pristine supporting conditions, but I always tell people this: it doesn't. Even if you only sit for 5 minutes, or if you only keep the five precepts and do nothing else, in your Buddhist life, you keep developing. You're creating the conditions which are basically moving you further down the path. But because the path, it's not what's the right words? It's not like you just can't race. You just can't move. Very, very few people can move at an incredible speed. The vast majority of us, it's like we're plodding along. You can maybe maximize your potential, but I always see even people who come into the monastery, as the weeks go by, you see small changes, in their character, and every single scrap of effort you put forward in a wholesome way, it's going to get good results.
Okay, so that will actually lift the glass ceiling every little bit of effort.
Yeah, you're definitely going to keep on the karmic level, on the level karma and rebirth and spiritual development. As long as you apply your efforts skillfully in these different areas, whether it's knowledge, investigation, meditation, generosity, keeping the precepts to the best of your ability, really studying the teaching in depth, you have to keep improving in all these different areas. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're just crawling and stumbling along. That's not the case. But because it takes so long for the monastics, it could take even two lives, even possibly three lives, as a monastic before you break through. But once you break through, the time scale is incredibly short. I mean, most people, they can wrap it up even at the level of a sotapanna. If you've got pristine supporting conditions, most people they do not go past the it's usually about the 10-year mark, or maybe slightly further. They finish from the sotapanna stage to the arahant. The vast majority of individuals, they've got it wrapped up in 10 years, So, and even before that point, if you've got the jhanas, at least say talking about very incredibly stable meditation, first jhana up to fourth jhana, and you really know exactly what you're doing with your practice, and you're doing 6 to 10 hours of practice, samadhi, reflection, virtually almost every day, say absolute minimum 5 to 6 hours for a number of years, people, they still don't go past the 5 to 10 year mark, even just for the first level, because they've got the samadhi power to really investigate quite deeply. So they always, with every scrap of effort, they always improve. But you may feel within yourself that you're not making incredible development, but the people around you, they can see it.
No, quite the opposite. Quite the opposite, that if you start doing serious meditation for and the full package deal of practicing the Dharma, what I find is that the whole transformative process occurs in my life where doors open, things which were restricted become more freer, and it's not that at all. It's quite the opposite. I don't feel retarded. I feel blown away sometimes by the level of freedom that develops when one makes serious commitment to all-round practice, especially deep levels and fairly substantial levels of meditation.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely, no doubt. But it is very subjective because I know.
Sure,
I know,
that's what I was worrying about.
I know people who would do 3 to 4 hours of meditation a day in with their lay practice, but you know, they basically they streamlined their lifestyle. But these people were still maybe a little bit like a bear with a sore head. They were still prey to anger. You know, they've been following this format for maybe 12 months and still an angry person. And but you know, and even on meditation retreat, you know, sometimes people make comments to me that they feel that they're getting nowhere. You know, I tell people essentially to just to keep yourself in a comfortable range. Mm-hmm. Even if you only do 3 hours, you know, you're doing a 9-10 day retreat, even like 3 or 4 hours a day. But as long as you keep yourself in a comfortable range, because you find that the overall effects are better in the long run. You know, people can push really, really hard, and they can get very tense and uptight. But you know, it's quite painful. And most people, they can't take it. Even the monastics, you know, if you get some of the monks doing 10 hours a day, doing that for like 1, 2, 3 weeks, you know, most people, you know, they can't stand it. They just don't have the underlying ability to practice at that.
It's driven by willpower, Bhante, and the opposite of that, the other end of the polarity from that, you know, I'm going to do it, is this whole thing where the mind inclines naturally towards stillness. And if there's a natural inclination towards sitting for 2 and 3 and 4 hours a day, that's a whole different ballpark.
Yeah, as long as you feel, you see that you're getting good results, you're comfortable with it, you can sustain it on a day-to-day basis, all well and good. Because every person, they know their strengths, their limits. So each individual will see. But it's good to experiment, because you know how does a person know exactly what they're capable of if they don't, you know, if they push it a bit, then they relax, you know, and then things get a bit difficult, they relax, and you know, you can adjust the practice in many, many different ways.
Thank you, Bhante. Yeah.
So let's have a look here. Let's see. Then they are energetic in abandoning unwholesome states and in undertaking wholesome states, steadfast, launching their efforts with firmness and persevering in cultivating wholesome states. Then they are wise, they possess wisdom regarding rise and disappearance that is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. These are the 5 factors of striving. There are these 4 caste ranking, the nobles, the Brahmins, the merchants and the workers. Now, if they possess these 5 factors of striving, it would lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Venerable Sir, there are these 4 castes, the nobles, the Brahmins, the merchants, the workers. Now, if they possess these 5 factors of striving, would there be any difference among them here in that respect? And naturally, there wouldn't be, when regardless of a person's status in society. You know, you're working with the, you know, on the level of the mind. You know, the mind has from one person to another. You know, the mind has characteristics and has potentials which may be slightly different according to the individual's capability, you know, their own personal development. But you know, the mind can be worked in different ways in relation with the path. And, you know, being a poor and underprivileged, as all of you are well aware, being poor and underprivileged, or being having a comfortable, more affluent lifestyle doesn't affect the mind to a degree which restricts or, you know, would inhibit a person's spiritual potential just because of the social class. Here, Great King, I say that the difference among them would lie in the diversity of their striving. Suppose there were 2 tameable elephants or tameable horses or tameable oxen that were well-tamed and well-disciplined, and 2 tameable elephants or tameable horses or tameable oxen that were untamed and undisciplined.
What do you think, Great King? Would the two tameable elephants, horses or oxen that were well-tamed and well-disciplined being tamed acquire the behaviour of the tamed? That's in reference. They talk about this business with the level of the you know, when a person, an enlightened disciple, they call the reference is like the grade of the tamed. The person's personal development is at the grade of the trained. The person who's really trained themselves and realized the those very, very high spiritual attainments. Would they arrive at the grade of the tamed? Yes, Venerable Sir. And would the two tameable elephants, horses or oxen that were untamed and undisciplined, being untamed, acquired the behaviour of the tamed? Would they arrive at the grade of the tamed, like the two elephants, horses, oxen that were well-tamed and well-disciplined? No, Venerable Sir. So too, Great King, it is not possible that what can be achieved by one who has faith, who is free from illness, who is honest and sincere, who is energetic and who is wise, can be achieved by one who has no faith, who has much illness, who is fraudulent and deceitful, who is lazy and who is not wise. What the Blessed One has said appears reasonable. What the Blessed One has said appears to be supported by reason. There are these four castes, Venerable Sir, the nobles, Brahmins, merchants, workers. Now, if they possessed these five factors of striving, and if their striving was right, so, you know, five factors of striving, and when they say their striving was right, it's actually, you know, meaning correct. They're moving in the, a skillful direction as far as the mind and body development. Would there be any difference among them in that respect? Here, Great King, in this respect, I say that among them there is no difference, that is, between the deliverance of one and the deliverance of the others. Suppose a man took dry sucker wood, lit a fire and produced heat. Another man took dry sala wood, lit a fire and produced heat. Another man took dry mango wood, lit a fire and produced heat. Another man took dry fig wood, lit a fire and produced heat. What do you think, Great King? Would there be any difference among these fires lit with different kinds of wood? That is, between the flame of one and the flame of the others, or between the colour of one and the colour of the others, or between the radiance of one and the radiance of the others? No, Venerable Sir. So too, Great King, when a fire is kindled by energy, lit by striving, there is, I say, no difference, that is, between the deliverance of one and the deliverance of the others. So as long as you have the supporting principles for practice, you know, virtually all human beings have the potential for enlightenment, except, you know, there are exceptions, naturally, people who have, real, say, psychiatric disturbance, or it could be, what would you call it, mental challenges in relation, say, with, retardation, crippled, this type of thing. There may be, there could be, like, birth conditions which, or developmental conditions which would compromise the person's potential. What the Blessed One has said appears reasonable. What the Blessed One has said appears to be supported by reason. But, Venerable Sir, how is it, are there gods? Why do you ask that, Great King? Venerable Sir, I was asking whether those gods come back to this human state or whether they do not. Great King, those gods who are still subject to affliction come back to this human state. Those gods who are no longer subject to affliction do not come back to this human state. So that was that reference there. The suggestion was that the former class of gods who are not afflicted are supposedly non-returners. So that's the third level of enlightenment. But as many of you are aware, that the Anagamis, they are born in the Sudawasa, within the five. You know, you have five specific worlds for the Anagami attainment, and they are the individuals who do not, who are not reborn in lower worlds. They pass away into full Nibbana from that specific realm in the Sudawasa. So they attain full Nibbana, full extinction. When this is said, we do Daba, ask the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, those gods who are still subject to affliction who come back to this human state, topple or banish from that place those gods who are no longer subject to affliction and those who do not come back to this human state. But even with the, you know, at the Anagami level, you know, you're looking at worlds of mind, very, very, very pure mind consciousness, and those beings would have, I mean, they really should have no intention. The underlying defilements are not there, which would bring them into, say, conflict with other streams of consciousness which actually exist in that world. They don't have the underlying defilements. Say, for example, the gods of the 33 or the gods that you see in the Deva realms, you know, there can be a basis for conflict, for disputation, or it could be like even rivalry to at least a small degree. Then the Venerable Ananda thought, this general Widu Daba is the son of the King Prasenajit of Kosala, and I am the son of the Blessed One. This is the time for one son to talk with the other. He said to General Widu Daba, General, I shall ask you a question in return. Answer it as you choose, General. What do you think? There is the whole extent of King Prasenajit of Kosala's realm where he exercises lordship and sovereignty. Now, can King Prasenajit of Kosala topple or banish from that place any recluse or Brahmin, irrespective of whether that recluse or Brahmin has merit or not, and whether he leads the holy life or not? He can do so, sire. What do you think, General? There is the whole extent that is not King Prasenajit of Kosala's realm, where he does not exercise lordship and sovereignty, nor can King Prasenajit of Kosala topple or banish from that place any recluse or Brahmin, irrespective of whether that recluse or Brahmin has merit or not, and whether he leads the holy life or not. He cannot do so, sir. General, what do you think? Have you heard of the gods of the 33? Yes, sir, I have heard of them, and King Prasenajit of Kosala has heard of them too. General, what do you think? Can King Prasenajit of Kosala topple the gods of the 33 or banish them from that place? Sir, King Prasenajit of Kosala cannot even see the gods of the 33. So how could he topple them or banish them from that place? So this whole business with the Devaloka, that essentially people, they need the in a general sense, the psychic eye to have the ability to actually see these beings. You may have individuals who are born with a degree of psychic potential, but you know, that particular individual, they don't get something for nothing. You know, anyone that you see who's got real potential in that area, yeah, you know, virtually guarantee that they've developed it in the past, and they've developed their meditation and their samadhi to the point where they were able to direct their mind in that way, to come and know and understand and see these things just through the power of their intention. When you have upachara samadhi, then you have the ability to do this kind of thing. And naturally, the power of the meditation, it's going to limit the extent, the range, how far you can take your mind with one particular psychic skill, and how and the number of psychic skills that you could actually work at that point in your life if you were interested in that area. So too, General, those gods who are still subject to affliction and who come back to this human state cannot even see those gods who are no longer subject to affliction and who do not come back to this human state. So how could they topple them or banish them from that place? Then King Prasenajit of Kosala asked the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, what is this bhikkhu's name? His name is Ananda, great king. Ananda, joy. He is indeed, Venerable Sir, and Ananda, he appears, what? The Venerable Ananda has said appears reasonable. What he has said appears to be supported by reason. But Venerable Sir, how is it? Are there Brahmas? Why do you ask that, great king? Venerable Sir, I was asking whether those Brahmas come back to this human state or whether they do not. And as many of you are aware in the suttas, that for beings who are born above the human realm, whether it's the Devaloka or the Brahmaloka, the vast majority of those beings, when they fall from that state
and they take rebirth. The vast majority are reborn below the human world. It's actually, you know, not saying I know, but it's actually it's in the sutta. It's a sutta rendering. They fall below the human world because you can't. It takes, I mean, quite a degree of personal development and karma to take you up to the Brahma Loka. But once it's expired, if you don't have any supporting karma, you may certainly fall below the human world. Mm. Yep. Yeah, they've exhausted the good karma, which has brought them up to the high state, say the Brahma world. But even, for example, an indication that you can see is if a person's reborn from Brahmaloka to the human world, that person will have a real potential for meditation practice. Especially, there's usually the wisdom is usually, you know, for most people, it's not that far behind. You know, a person can be very high developed, could have a very, very solid samadhi practice, and you can neglect the wisdom practice to a degree. You know, so for example, you know, you can go all the way to the eighth arupa jhana and not attain sotapanna. You know, you just go on the line of pure samadhi. And if you can go right to the limit, with say pure samadhi, and then and not actually attain to Dhamma. But if you choose to investigate and reflect, you tend to move very, very fast, because the fourth jhana is supposed to be the one of the optimum, or say the optimum. Even with the Buddha said, you know, with the sutta renderings, you know, you see very clearly that the fourth jhana is the, this is only with what the Buddha said, the optimum state for vipassana, for the wisdom practice. But, you know, even if you go up to the eighth jhana, which is even more refined, it's not necessary for you to go that far. The fourth jhana, the mind reaches the peak of its power as far as vipassana goes. You can go higher if you like. But you know, from what the suttas say, it's not necessary to go to the full extent, you know, right to the limits of samadhi. The mind's got more than enough power to cut through the defilements. Then a man announced to King Pasenadi Kosala, "Great King Sanjaya, the Brahman of the Akasa clan has come." King Pasenadi of Kosala asked Sanjaya, the Brahman of the Akasa clan, "Brahman, who introduced this story to the palace?" "Sai, it was General Widubada." General Widubada said, "Sai, it was Sanjaya, the Brahman of the Akasa clan." Then a man announced to King Pasenadi of Kosala, "Sai, it is time to depart." King Pasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, we have asked the Blessed One about omniscience." And the Buddha replied, "Omniscience in the sense of the enlightened mind, what the enlightened mind knows and understands, the range of its capability, what it can know and see." And the Blessed One has answered about omniscience. "We approve of and accept that answer, and we are satisfied. We have asked the Blessed One about purification in the four castes, and the Blessed One has answered about purification in the four castes. We approve of and accept that answer, and so we are satisfied. We have asked the Blessed One about the gods, and the Blessed One has answered about the gods. We approve of and accept that answer, and so we are satisfied. We have asked the Blessed One about the Brahmins, and the Blessed One has answered about the Brahmins. We approve of and accept that answer, and so we are satisfied. Whatever we asked the Blessed One, that the Blessed One has answered. We approve of and accept those answers, and so we are satisfied. And now, Venerable Sir, we depart. We are busy and have much to do. Now is the time, Great King, to do as you think fit." Then King Pasenadi of Kosala, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's word, rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. Are there any questions at all? Any? So if a sotapanna...
If a sotapanna goes to the Brahma world or Deva...
Deva world.
Reborn. And will that person be reborn back in lower in than human race?
No, they can't fall below the human state. So sotapannas and once returners, they either move in the human world or the Buddha's rendering was human and celestial abodes, and but when you're talking celestial, you know, I mean realistically it could mean Brahmaloka as well, because say for example you've got a person who's a sotapanna, and sotapannas have the ability to whether they're a lay disciple or a monastic, they have a real ability to work the jhanas consistently, depending on their workload, how busy they are, how much time they've got on their hands, duties, responsibilities, this type of thing. So that person that you see who comes back, or say for example, to lose the plot there. So because the reason why they can't fall below the human realm is because they have attained to Dhamma, they've realized those deep insight knowledges, paticca sumapada, realization of anicca, dukkha, anatta, non-self principle. They've cut away the first three fetters. Was it skeptical doubt, attachment to rites and rituals? Skeptical doubt, rites and rituals. What's the third one? Sorry? Yeah. Personality view. They've actually seen that the personality doesn't exist as an enduring entity, like over time, you know, from life to life. So a person who realizes Nibbana element realizes the unconditioned. They know intrinsically at a very profound level that the personality it's not a true enduring entity. It's a flux of forces. It's a flux of mental energies, forces. You know, the personality structure. It's a conditioned phenomena, and it's not something which is stable and which will go on from one life to the next or following. But the sotapanna, if they're reborn in the human world, they can get their practice together really, really quick, because the potential for the jhanas, it's already there. All you have to do, even as a lay disciple, if they've got the supporting conditions, they could work it without great difficulty. With the monastics, it's virtually guaranteed. So if you ever see someone in that category, it might indicate the previous development of that person, but you will also have people who are reborn, who are not attained, who are reborn, who fall from Brahmaloka, but they also have a potential for deep meditation as well, and insight if they choose, you know, insight up to the same level, you know, if their practice is quite well rounded, but the underlying, when you look at the faculties, the faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, wisdom, with the sotapanna, they are really pronounced. They're beyond the normal range. The person who falls from Brahmaloka to the human realm has real potential for deep meditation, but the strength of the faculties, they're not at the same level as the sotapanna. So if you see any sotapanna that you see anywhere in the world, these people, their ability, what they can do, it's not only what they can actually do in meditation, but the ability to teach, the level of energy, the ability to their understanding of people, their ability to do things in the world or within the circle of Dhamma. It's far greater than a person who hasn't actually realized that attainment on a profound level. Did anybody have anything else? Yes, lady.
could fall to below a human noun because I run out of good karma.
Well, not to say that I know psychically, but the Buddha stated in the suttas, he said the vast majority of even beings in the Deva Loka, Brahma Loka, the vast majority of those beings, they fall below the human realm, and the reason they fall below the human realm is because they haven't got the supporting karma, supporting good karma, which will eventually stabilize them in the human realm.
So how did they get there to begin with?
Sorry, how do they?
How did they get there to begin with into that Brahma Loka?
Essentially it's through meditation development. In order to reach, say for example, the first three Brahma realms, which are within the parameters of the first jhana. So for the person who has a mild mastery of the first jhana, potentially you are reborn in the retinue, the outer circle of Brahma. If you have a middle degree of mastery with the first jhana, you are born within the circle of Brahma's ministers, of the Mahabrahma, the great Brahma, who is the top, the number one honcho in that being. He's the top ranked being who was reborn in that world with the birth story. And then when you have the full mastery of the first jhana, you are reborn as Mahabrahma. But the thing is, you can be reborn as Mahabrahma in another world, in another space and time. You can have I can't think of the supporting suttas. You can check this one with Achyam Brahmani because he's done an incredible amount of study. But I'll look this one up. You can have different worlds in time and in space, both time and space, where you can have beings have attained to the state of Mahabrahma in their own specific world with their own abiding with the lower classes of beings in these worlds. So with the cosmology, it's incredibly precise as far as when we talk about natural law, dimensions and energies and whatnot. But if you have, say for example, if you have the potential for really profound meditation and where you take rebirth, you will be the top ranked. If you have mastery of, say, the first, you've got to be very specific. You've got mastery of the first jhana only. You will be reborn in a world where you are essentially the top ranked being, and everyone else in that world is either at the minister level or within the circle of the retinue of Brahma. But that's the way it works on the level of cosmology. But you can look into it. But I'll check it out when I get back. Is there any other questions before we finish up? Okay. Thank you for your kind attention.